Welcome to The Laundry List on CFCR 90.5 FM. You are here tonight with one of the hosts, Chloe, and I am interviewing an amazing woman who is talking to me all the way from London, England. Her name is Amma Josephine Budge, and I'd like to welcome her to our show. Welcome, Amma.
Thank you, Chloe. It's wonderful to be here.
We get to see each other, but the audience gets to just listen to us. But yeah, we're two amazing women who are looking at each other and talking about some fantastic stuff. So I wanted to bring Amma to the show because I've known her for a few years and I know she's doing some amazing work. But recently, she just came back from a conference, which was kind of the tail end of one of her trips. And that conference was in Johannesburg in South Africa at Wits University. And she presented at a Decolonizing Feminism conference. And I'm going to read you a little bit from her paper that she sort of talked on. And then we're going to get into it. So here is what Amma said. As I watched the couple in the play try to work their way through not only the turbulences of a relationship, but also the realities of wanting to have a child in an increasingly disintegrating world, I felt as though I was sitting in the center of that stage with an audience all around me, grilling me, dissecting my childhood fantasies of marriage, babies, white picket fences. Whatever conditioning had clung on despite the years of anti-racist, feminist purging. And I realized that climate change isn't just about blame and accountability, figures and demographics. It's about entitlement. It's about the fact that despite knowing that the carbon emissions of my child, 10,000 tons of CO2, if raised in Europe or North America, will quite literally eat up so much more than their quote-unquote fair share of an increasingly limited pie, I still want one. And that wanting, in its deliberately oblivious totality, deems itself more important than the wants and lives of others. Woo! So that was just a little blurb from Amma's paper. And I, you know what? I failed to say that Amma's doing her MA in post-colonial culture and global policy, which is why she was talking about this. So you guys don't know that Amma's sort of journey through her MA has seen some shifts and changes. And this is sort of one of the avenues, the lead push for you, Amma.
Yes,
and so
yes,
now you're focusing on this concept. So this is going to be really hard, but can you talk a little more about this idea? Like, for a lot of people, I think the concept of feminism, and let's just make it nice and general, environmentalism, if you will, that's not seen a lot. And so not only have you approached that subject, but you have kind of brought it down right to the level of what is the environmental cost of reproducing? How does that affect the world? How can we look at it? So can you just talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, and I would add also, and why is that a feminist issue?
Right.
I've had quite a lot of people saying, you know, well, yes, climate change, but why is it a feminist issue? And I put in the paper that actually all issues in the world, if we're looking at migration, if we're looking at population growth, if we're looking at war and political instability, if we're looking at famine, if we're looking at drought, are all actually climate issues and climate-related issues, and not seeing them as... So I've always been a feminist. I was raised by feminists. And it's very much been about marrying that feminism with now looking at everything as being a climate issue. So, for example, if I'm looking at the Cold War, I studied the Cold War in school, and I studied it as this very isolated incident that happened for a certain number of years, completely unrelated to anything else.
Right.
So there was a little bit of conversation about how the fallout of World War II affected the Cold War, but not really. Okay. But suddenly understanding, okay, if I'm studying decolonization on the African continent, for example, how was that affected by the Cold War? And how was the Cold War then affected by World War II and World War II by World War I and World War I by colonization and the first countries that became independent and the first pushbacks from the colonies in, you know, in the 20th century? And so suddenly you start to kind of get this very global perspective of the domino effect of everything.
Right. And you can see the connection all of a sudden, the thread that runs
exactly. Exactly. So suddenly we're not just talking about deforestation in Brazil or the aluminium that's going into Mac computers in Silicon Valley. We're talking about a whole global network that is interdependent. And of course we think, okay, that's really obvious. But actually, when you then realize, oh my God, that means that how I live my life in terms of everything I do is affecting that huge interconnected web, it suddenly becomes a little bit more tricky. And then of course, we think, oh, that just means I need to recycle, or that just means I need to only have one car, or that just means that I need to only have one computer and make it last 10 years and we all share it in my house. And that's very, it's a very trendy way of being eco-friendly. And it's not that those things aren't a part of being environmentally friendly, they are a part of it, but it's actually a very minuscule part of it when you really consider what people who are in high consuming areas of the world, which is mostly North America, Europe, parts of China, parts of India, the way that what they're actually willing to give up. Because eventually, if we continue going the way we're going, we're all going to have to give up a lot more than we're willing to give up now. So it's somehow illogical that we're not willing to give up more now in order to save ourselves a little bit later.
And sorry to interrupt, but that I find that fascinating because I too have been raised feminist, and I, from an early age, I was a big environmentalist, like from high school years on. And so I was always cognizant of stuff like that. But what's interesting that's never, I've seen never really been part of the conversation is, what are you willing to give up? Because anything we do from now on is going to have to involve giving something up, because you know, there's a lot of people who are like, I don't have time to bring my shopping bags in to the grocery store so that I, you know, I'll just get the plastic stuff. And I've always thought, you know, carbon emissions, all that stuff. I just think someone needs to get hard-assed and say, no, no more plastic, no more cars, no more, I don't know, whatever. But it needs to come down to that point because I don't feel like the whole world hasn't yet gotten to the point where they have been forced into having to give something up in order to make a change.
Absolutely. And I think that thing of not having time is really interesting because in this high capitalist consumer world, time is the most valuable currency that we have, actually. And it's the thing that we continuously are giving up, you know, and we're not considering that as something that we're giving up. It's something that we don't have a choice over. We don't have a choice over working, you know, 60-hour weeks, but actually, if we lived differently, would we have a choice over working a 60-hour week? And wouldn't we value our time more than we'd value being able to get that extra bag of, you know, organic kidney beans or whatever?
Right.
So I think that reproduction, the reason why I was focusing on reproduction is a really interesting way to look at this, is because it kind of cuts out that whole thing of I don't have time to take my plastic bags to the grocers, because right, it's not that you don't have time to have a baby, because a baby takes up all of the time.
Right.
And it is much more of an active choice if you're living in a place where abortion is readily available and you come from, and you are in a space where it's an option for you. But it is also a choice in that it's something that we try for, you know, we try to have babies. It's not actually that easy to conceive a baby. You often have to try quite hard. And it's something that your whole life becomes geared up to. And society tells you that, the media tells you that, your family tells you that, your quote unquote body clock that I definitely contest tells you that. And so what happens when we're thinking, okay, am I willing to give up having a child? And why is that such a hardship, actually? Why is me reproducing this sacred, age-old, primal thing, apparently, that is beyond a future I can conceive of without a child? It's just completely, it's unconceivable. And anybody who doesn't have a child in their future has failed, is miserable, is depressed. We have to be sorry for them, and they've actually just defied their purpose on this planet.
I was just flipping through your paper because I think you mentioned something about that, about the failure if you choose as a woman to not reproduce. The implications of that, the assumptions made because of that, are so damaging and so personal and
So perfect.
so demoralizing, like as if you've done the world some sort of massive disservice.
And once again, your biology, right, your body becomes public property. It becomes something everybody else is able to have a judgment over, and also something that you should have given to society. You should have given your body to society as a reproductive, entity.
Because you owe it to society.
Because you owe it to, exactly, you owe it to your species, which is another really interesting, idea when we think that how, how much human beings are overpopulating the earth right now. I wonder how much we owe to other species.
Well, that's just it. Because I was going to say the reality is that the reality of that statement is the actual opposite. We owe the world to not reproduce more, to not continue that behavior on because we're already overpopulated, correct? From what I understand.
Absolutely.
So, in fact, we should be celebrated for not going ahead and reproducing because we're helping out things, but you're right, it seems to be a global attitude of you did this to us, why would you choose that? You're a woman, isn't
Absolutely.
it natural that your next step is to have a baby?
And I mean, my kind of argument about the whole, it's a basic human instinct thing, is there are lots of things that are basic human instincts that we override every day, that we have overridden over hundreds of years. So this idea of it's a basic instinct also, I think, needs to be questioned, because it's not that you might be born with a basic instinct to kill the person who's trying to take your lover. You're not going to act on that basic instinct because of social conditioning. So, and we don't know how much, well, of course, some people do, but we don't know how much that social conditioning is affecting our quote unquote basic instincts anyway. And so it becomes an incredibly manipulatable argument, because anybody can tell you, no, this is your basic instinct. And that becomes, you can't argue with that. That's it. It's your basic human instinct, and it's your basic human right. But is that just because then all of the nappy companies, or diaper companies as you call them, and milk production companies, and how the housing market and all of these different bodies are making huge amounts of money off of you having the babies? And that
Yes.
economic side cannot be forgotten. And I think I just want to go back to what you're saying as well in terms of a responsibility to the species, because the species is also not just the people who look like me who live in my neighborhood, right?
Right.
And so my paper, I mean, I'm mixed race, I'm half Ghanaian, I grew up between there and between Accra and London, and I've always had a very clear understanding of myself as also an African, and also a privileged person of color, I would say. So if I have a baby in London, the emissions of that baby are going to be very, very different to if I have a baby in Ghana, for example. And that racialized factor becomes really important when you start thinking, okay, so the amount, the bodies that are reproducing that are high consuming are almost entirely white bodies. They're majority white bodies. And the bodies that are on the front lines of climate change, so that's not only indigenous groups in North America, but it's predominantly indigenous groups in South America. It's black and brown bodies in sub-Saharan Africa. It's South Asian and Southeast Asian and other people from across the Asian continent's bodies. Bangladesh is a very high peak zone. South Africa is a high peak zone. Brazil is a high peak zone. Bolivia is a high peak zone. And those are majority brown bodies who are being quite literally wiped out. And so it becomes a racialized dynamic.
And is part of that issue too that we're not that those people are not being involved in the I'm trying to think, is it the fight or whatever, that only women who are privileged primarily are the ones who are talking about the concept of choice and not talking about the impact of our decisions on the climate. I don't know, because I don't live in those countries and I don't speak those languages, so I don't know. Is this stuff being talked about elsewhere? Like, the conference that you attended, this was the first time they had this conference, is that right?
Yeah, it was the first time. And I think that's a really interesting question, because one of my biggest critiques of the conference, or I should say surprises, was that I was the only person talking about climate change. I was one of the only people actually talking about the land in any kind of tangible way, which kind of shocked me. I mean, yes. I think it's something like 83 million rand, that, which is a South African currency. I guess it would be something like, I have to check exactly how many thousands of dollars, but yeah, it's a lot of money that they have been paying out just this year, that South Africa paid out for drought relief, for example. Mm. And we have huge amounts of desertification and reduction in fertility in the soil happening across sub-Saharan Africa. This is affecting people on a very, very day-to-day level. It's a huge amount of amount of the population are farmers, are very affected by that agriculture, but I'm the only person talking about climate change, and I'm an outsider. I'm not South African. And so that really interested me. And I think that in some ways it's not that, of course, many, many, many groups are far more cognizant, are far more aware, are far more active than most white groups in the world, many indigenous groups in Canada, in many Native American groups are very, very active in the States. Activists are, especially women, I mean, Indian women are incredible mobilizers. I mean, Vandana Shiva, who's an amazing Indian writer, is one of the writes incredibly on the women, especially the Dalit women, who are mobilizing around protecting their environments and their livelihoods. So it's not that they're not involved, yeah, but it is that I think they don't have all of the information. So a lot of, an analogy that I would have used is Lake Turkana, which is one of the biggest lakes in the world, goes through Kenya and Tanzania, has been shrinking increasingly rapidly since the Industrial Revolution. So you look at the kind of video and you see over about 100 years that you just see the water decreasing, massively shrinking. So you have tribes who've lived across that lake, and there was one Kenyan tribe who were interviewed living on the edge of that lake, and the grandfather says, I grew up and this village was on the edge of the lake. Everyone says, now I walk 2 hours to get a lake. That's just within two generations. And so they'll say, we understand this is because of climate change. They'll say, we understand this is because the earth is getting hotter, because people are there, are researching, are talking to them about it. They understand that it's getting hotter. They feel it getting hotter. They see the water receding. They understand there's less fish. And apparently this is because of climate change. What they don't necessarily are not necessarily given the information of, especially because you've got mostly white, often European or American aid workers going there, what they don't know is the reason why climate change is increasing so rapidly is because the governments and the private sectors of your countries, of European countries, of North American countries, are refusing to commit to any kind of climate emission cutbacks, any kind of curbing of lifestyle and economic growth that is massively ecologically unstable at the expense of your lives. So you can say, the village next to me is gone. Everybody has been wiped out in the last 10 years from a drought.
Right.
But you can't say, that's on your hands.
Right. And I think that's global, in that everybody is not connected to that. Like, they don't understand the global implications of their own individual choices and or decisions. And
yeah,
that absolutely, you're right about the implications of what, yes, climate change exists. Yeah, there's some people who are doing things about it, but really, you know, what am I going to be able to do? And I think we certainly see that in Canada with the Northern Indigenous population talking about the exact same issue, right? Like pollution in the mother's breast milk, the loss of ice very quickly, more than ever before, and the elders of the Indigenous people talking about, you know, this has never been seen before. We are losing animals left, right, and center because of this. But then the conversation kind of stops there. What, you know, okay then, what are we going to do about this? On whole, what are we going to do about this? Anyway, I just want to interject because for those of you who might be tuning in, you are listening to 90.5 FM CFCR, The Laundry List. The host is here, Chloe, and I am interviewing an amazing woman, Amma, who is talking to us from London, England, and we're talking about climate change, but from a feminist perspective, I guess. And so Amma was just explaining how the work she's doing with regards to sort of the environmental impacts of, oh, I don't know, I'm trying to synopsize it, but just looking at not just everything, but I think the aspect of it too, this whole idea of how having children affects things on a global scale and who is it affecting and how are we, you know, being part of that? And so it's interesting what you're saying about going to those places and realizing, yes, but, you know, you were the only, you know, brown person there talking about climate change and that it was still kind of a new idea. And I'm assuming the same happens here and happens in the States, happens everywhere. So, and I like to, Amma, because you're based in London, England, and that looking at it from the perspective of global migration and refugees and all the rest of it, those issues. But kind of, can you give us an idea of maybe where are you heading with this info next? What kind of, what directions are you looking at wanting to go down? Or are you wrapping this up? Or what's your, what are your plans, Missy?
Oh, what a question. I think that I definitely want to keep talking about this in feminist spaces because, you know, I conclude in the paper that I delivered by saying, you know, this is a feminist issue, all kinds of reasons. Reasons, some of them I can't even explain to you, but I can feel them in my gut. I feel that we need to be talking about this. And talking about this as a feminist is the only way I know how to talk about it. But also on a very practical level, as soon as we're talking about reproduction, the potential comes to police women's bodies, right? You have a potential of a government saying, oh, fine, we'll take your paper and we'll put a trial out on limiting women having babies and see if that does mean anything. And that's totally not what the paper is about. It's not about telling women to stop having babies. It's about telling women to think about what their reproduction is doing and whether or not they have to have babies, or is that the only option? Have they considered having a life without babies? Have they considered adopting? Have they actually considered an alternative way? And for me, that's an entirely feminist baseline critique, is have you considered an alternative to getting married, having two children, quitting your job, and never, you know, and that's it, that's your life. And it's fine if you choose to do that, but have you considered an alternative?
And exactly, and being cognizant of that decision and the global the global implications of that decision. And I don't think that that's a conversation that's happening right now. Certainly not in my field, and not
staying off of that decision.
Yeah, not in the general societal conversations, like. I'm interested to see on a go-forward basis what we notice in society. Who's going to be talking about this? How is it going to come up? You know, even everything from, I was just reading an article on Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and they interviewed Melinda Gates, and she was talking about their work on reproductive issues in the developing countries, and she talked specifically, I think it was Kenya, but don't quote me on that. Anyway, she was explaining how the approach they're trying to take is no longer focused on the women. It's focused on the men and getting the men to understand what the implications of having children is and saying to them, this isn't just a woman's decision, if you will. It's also a man's in that you're responsible for this. You're responsible for wearing condoms. You're responsible for respecting if your wife doesn't want to have a child. You're responsible for all of that. And she said, these conversations are not happening in these countries very easily. And so I appreciated that, you know, they're approaching it from a different perspective. And like what you said, it's no longer like you can't have children or you shouldn't have children. But it's also saying from in a different way, you need to think more about this and you need to realize how much you are responsible for. And that I would hope that that would then also free up women to say, yeah, you know what? I'm not interested in having another kid. I don't want to do that. We don't need to. I don't want to. I don't have to. And see where that goes. Anyway, my dear, I need to end our conversation because this is only a half hour show. And if I don't end it now, we'll never, ever stop talking.
Well, can I just input that I'm based in London, but I travel a lot and I'm totally up for having these conversations. If anybody wants to get in touch with me, okay. They can. You can tweet me at amjamb, which is AMJAMB. And I'll get Chloe to put my website up on the podcast as well. Yes. It's just amajosephinebudge.com. So you can also find me and email me through that.
And I'll put all this info on our Facebook page so that listeners can go there and get all the links to your stuff and then kind of go from there.
Absolutely. And if I can just conclude to say, we need to be talking about this here. You need to be talking about it in Canada, in the States, in Europe. And the focus is not so much on going over there and helping the brown people fixing, you know, their lives. It's very much about our actions and us being a part of this umbilical relationship.
Absolutely. And thank you for you know, saying that, for synopsizing it in that way, because I think that's an important message, is that, like most things, it starts with us. And that's where we need to be focused on, is ourselves and making a change from that perspective. So thank you, Anna.
Thank you.
Thank you to everybody who listened tonight. And tune in next week for another show, Monday nights at 6 on 90.5 FM. So good night.
Good night.